Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
These are all the remains of human beings.
Death and despair as COVID ravages India. With the government facing criticism, I asked top ruling party official Narendra Taneja. And
America is on the move again.
President Biden sells his ambitious agenda. What do Republicans think? I ask Indiana Senator Todd Young. Then, everyone's invited. Survivors unite on a platform for women to share their stories of misogyny and sexual violence. I talk to founder Soma Sera and feminist writer Camila Willingham. Plus,
classic force us to come to terms with the most terrifying question we could ever raise, which is, what does it mean to be human?
Making the case for the classics, prominent philosopher Cornel West tells Walter Isaacson why studying the great thinkers is critical if we want to avoid a spiritual catastrophe.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. India's COVID cases keep climbing. A new unenviable world record was set today when the country reported nearly 380,000 new infections. Gravediggers and crematoriums are overwhelmed by the number of bodies. The Indian government is facing heavy criticism for prematurely declaring victory over COVID and for allowing political rallies to take place despite the pandemic. Even today, Prime Minister Narendra Modi called for state elections in West Bengal to proceed in line with COVID protocols. But help is on the way. Oxygen and equipment from the UK, Russia and Singapore arrived today, and aid from the United States is expected Friday. Narendra Taneja is the national spokesman for Modi's ruling BJP party. He joined me earlier from New Delhi, and I started by asking him about the potential danger of elections continuing amidst this crisis.
Well, these were regional elections which had been going on the last 1.5 months. It was not just one date. There were several dates, and it was in various state assemblies, which got over, by the way, this evening, you know, about 3 hours ago. It's all over. But that was planned long time, in advance by Election Commission of India, which is a constitutional authority reporting only to Parliament. So government has nothing to do with it. There was no way the government could give them direct instructions because they are autonomous. They don't report to the government. But ever since, you know, this became clear that this wave was very strong and it was spreading fast across the country, you know, our party started appealing to the people as well as to, potential voters that stay away, take all precautions, use virtual platforms and use other platforms in order for communication both ways, from the political side, from the people side. Some people listen and some didn't, unfortunately. And that in some cases it might have been a kind of a spreader, super spreader. But these elections were in the area which are not so severely affected, but many parts of the country are. And that did send out a kind of message that, you know, as if the whole COVID was over, the threat of COVID was over. That was a bit unfortunate. But as I said, that was not in the hands of the government. And even otherwise, in most cases, the elections happened in the area which were not that severely affected at the time election actually coming.
Right, but now they are. So Mr. Taneja, let me ask you this. If you say it's not the government and it's not your party, will you then hold the Election Commission responsible for letting these rallies and things take place? I'm asking you because it's come under huge, huge criticism. And this week, you know, the Madras High Court has accused the Election Commission of being singularly responsible for the second wave. And the Chief Justice even saying that officials should probably be booked on murder charges for letting these rallies take place. Will your party, your government, then hold the Election Commission responsible?
Well, as you know, the Honorable Madras High Court that you referred to, we have read the judgment, their view, and we have also heard the views of several other platforms, judicial, media, think tanks, universities, intellectuals, so forth, and also some politicians. We have heard that. But as we said, that's the Election Commission of India is a highly revered institution, highly respected. And they took the decision that they took. And we, as a political party, for that matter, all political parties in India, they had no option to go along with it. And now, fortunately, the elections are over. and that's behind us.
But what's not behind you, obviously, is this surge, this second surge, which is, as you've explained, pretty much out of control. You need everything. You're accepting help for the first time in 15 years. So let me ask you about your party's responsibility and your prime minister's responsibility. As you know better than I do, there was a resolution adopted by your party in February, which said, "It can be said with pride that India defeated COVID-19 under the able, sensible, committed and visionary leadership of Prime Minister Modi. The party unequivocally hails its leadership for introducing India to the world as a proud and victorious nation in the fight against COVID." Now, you are, in fact, home to 18% of the world's population. And I just wonder whether that was just a little bit too early to be celebrating, a little bit like President George Bush when he said mission accomplished, when certainly it wasn't in the Iraq war. Do you regret that? Would you change that?
Well, I wouldn't go for any comparison with President Bush and so forth. But yes, the enthusiasm or optimism that was there in the language of the resolution probably, should have been more restrained. And many of us thought that language was a little bit too optimistic at that time. But that time, the situation in the country was very different. The number of cases was very small. Of a country of 1.38 billion, there were hardly 10,000 cases per day.
BJP chief minister in Uttarakhand state has said, "I invite all devotees across the world to come to Haridwar, take a holy dip in the Ganga. Nobody will be stopped in the name of COVID-19, as we assure the faith in God will overcome the fear of the virus." You know, this is a pattern, Mr. Taneja. This is a pattern of your government constantly urging people to go out, your party officials constantly urging people to go out. And anybody can see that these mass gatherings, whether it was in February or now, are super spreader events.
Well, it's not really correct to say that basically was indication of any pattern in the party or the government or for that matter, the Republic of India. Yes, the chief minister of that particular state you're referring to did make that statement. Many of us disagreed with him on that very day. And of course, the chief minister of that state should have been more cautious, more careful. But and many within the party, within the government and India as a whole didn't agree with him. And the people, that was a religious congregation called Kumbh Fair, which happens every 12 years, has been happening for thousands of years, 7,000 years and so forth. But that said, at the same time, the chief minister should have been more careful, should have consulted scientists and doctors before making any statement. But whether the event was a super spreader, definitely thousands of people came out of that congregation sick and had to be treated.
And finally, let me ask you about data denial, because, you seem to be putting all the onus on certain chief ministers, certain people. But let's face it, you're the party in power. These are your party members. When you said that it was perhaps too early to declare victory, you said perhaps the situation was different at that time. But I've been talking to epidemiologists and scientists and statisticians who say that there has been an amount of data denial in India, that actually for every case, there's an exponentially more cases, and for every death declared, there are exponentially more. Listen to the epidemiologist who spoke to me from the University of Michigan.
So 1 in 20 cases are being reported in India, and there's massive heterogeneity across the different cities and the rural areas in terms of this reporting structure. For deaths, I'd have to say that India has a very poor death recording system anyway. 1 out of 5 deaths are medically reported. But COVID-related deaths, we estimate that underreporting factor between 2 to 5.
Are you concerned now that you could be actually sitting on a problem that is 2 to 5 times as big as you're saying it is?
Well, I'm sitting in New Delhi as I speak with you, and New Delhi is the epicenter of the second wave of coronavirus. I'm in the middle of it. My son was down with COVID. He's just come out of it. I've lost 3 friends the last 10 days. I probably know better than the lady you just, you interviewed from Michigan. I can tell you that we sitting here know better about the ground situation than people sitting in Michigan or in other parts of the world. But I still respect that is science. That is their view and I respect the view. But the reality here, when it comes to data right now, the government, we are very busy handling the situation, saving lives, mobilizing equipment, organizing oxygen that people need and making sure that we can basically protect, our people from the second wave. So that's our primary focus in terms of we are a huge country. There are more people living in India than the whole of Africa. In terms of cremation grounds, graveyards in different parts of the country, of course, we have the data and we are collecting data, but all that will be reconciled once, we are out of the woods. Right now, our focus is more on how can we save lives and how can we mobilize more oxygen? How can we mobilize more, more medicines for our people and make sure that we get rid of the second wave as fast as possible? That's our primary focus. Political criticism, other kind of, commentaries, people are entitled to do that. But our focus right now, being the government, being the ruling party, if you want to tame onus, yes, of course, we are in power. We are the government in India. So, of course, responsibility is first and foremost ours, good or bad, whatever it is. I mean, it is our responsibility and we're trying our very level best. But this did come as a surprise today. A lot of people are saying that you should have done that. We knew in February, but that time, scientists, doctors, they were all more or less of the same view. We politicians formed the opinion that we were more or less getting out of COVID situation. Our views are basically coming out of the, kind of analysis, the kind of reports, feedback we were getting from scientists and doctors, including those living outside India, but Indians were living outside India. But evidently, something went wrong. Evidently, we were hit by tsunami. As you know, when tsunami hits you, then you very often you are not aware of that. And in most cases, 80 to 90%, reasons could be external. We don't know. We don't want to blame anybody. All we know is that, yes, we are in power. We are responsible. This happened. We are now, our focus is how can we save lives and how can we make sure our people are protected. International aid support is coming and we are in touch with various countries and we are very grateful to the countries and the people who are extending support to us. A fight is basically our focus is that, and our focus is how can we basically now defeat COVID and how can we overcome this. And I can share with you that we will overcome it and we shall overcome it very, very soon. We are tremendously resilient. Clearly, India is known for the resilience of the people.
Yeah, and Mr. Tenaje, obviously the world is looking very sympathetically at your country and hoping for the best for all the people there. Thank you so much indeed for joining me.
Thank you.
And as we said, American aid is going to be delivered starting Friday. And now President Joe Biden is in Georgia today, giving a nod to the state that helped Democrats clinch both the White House and the Senate. Those victories allowed Biden to push forward his ambitious agenda, which he laid out last night in a speech to a joint session of Congress. The president says America is badly in need of a revamp, especially if it wants to compete with China.
We're in competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century. We're at a great inflection point in history. We have to do more than just build back better. We have to build back better. We have to compete more strenuously than we have.
And President Biden's first 100 days has brought much better news on the U.S. economy, which soared in the first quarter. Here to respond is the Republican senator from Indiana, Todd Young, and he's joining me now from Washington. Senator Young, welcome to the program. Can I talk to you? I'm really interested in this bipartisan situation. You heard President Biden clearly tie the big investments that he's making to competitiveness, to be able to, as he said, compete for the 21st century, particularly against China. You yourself are also leading an initiative. It's called the Endless Frontier Act, a bipartisan effort to really invest hundreds of billions of dollars, government dollars, in tech and other related fields. So do you see there that there is connectivity between both aims? Do you see that you can work with the president on this piece of the pie?
Well, thank you for having me on, Christian. I do see real opportunities to work together as it relates to our national security and most especially as it relates to our resistance to the Chinese Communist Party and their violation of international rules and norms and the threat that they pose to our allies and to the United States of America. In fact, on this issue in particular, we need to show unity because the Chinese Communist Party is sending a message right now that the U.S. is divided on so many fronts. And when it comes to investing in key technologies, as we did in the wake of the Cold War, so that we might grow our economy at a more rapid rate and be able to harness many of those technologies to empower our war fighters to deter any sort of conflict, I think it's essential that we come together. That's why I've co-authored the Endless Frontier Act, and why I think it stands a great chance of support from Republicans and Democrats alike when it comes to the floor, I hope, next month.
Okay, so that's really interesting. You have just identified America's chief challenger, competitor, as pointing to the very thing that has pretty much stymied the United States for too many years now, this division, this, you know, fracturing and partisanship. And they're using it against you. So I wonder whether, especially now, people like yourself have got to gather more and more Republicans to, if for nothing else than to face down the enemy, so to speak. Because, you know, a new poll from CNN just showed that Americans overwhelmingly support bipartisanship. 87% say it's desirable in Congress, but expectations are low. 60% see bipartisanship as, quote, unlikely in upcoming legislation. So what do you make of that, given what you've just told me?
Well, what I make of it is that bipartisanship consists of both political parties coming together, making accommodations wherever necessary, but in the end, focusing on really big and important objectives of the American people. In this instance, it is preventing China from ripping off our intellectual property and continuing to prey on our workers and businesses and resisting their military encroachment the threat that they pose to keeping open the sea lines of communication for trade of the goods that we export and import. So we're going to have to come together around this issue. And bipartisanship, make no mistake, is not an end in and of itself, but it's a way to get things done. And oftentimes, when we work together, we crowd in the best ideas. We leave aside the worst ideas. And when it comes to investing in 21st century cutting edge technologies, there's a lot of overlap. So on this issue, at least, I have high confidence that we will come together. And frankly, Christian, we need to come together because the Chinese are watching us. The Chinese are watching whether or not we can come together as it relates to resisting them, their value system, and others. Our ability to attract allies, our ability to resist the Chinese moving forward will depend on using this moment in history as an opportunity to become a better version of ourselves and on ensuring that our values prevail. And that typically happens through economic growth and investment in our strategic capabilities, which give us more leverage to bring a country like China into a position of better behavior.
So, I assume, you know, you must be pleased to see that the economy, the Commerce Department said, has soared for this first quarter on an annualized basis and much better than it was doing towards the end of last year in the final quarter. So just to follow up on what you said.
I think it really bears emphasizing and reminding the American people at every turn that the only reason our economy was down in the first place was because of the gross irresponsibility, the recklessness of the Chinese Communist Party. It is they who cannot be trusted. It is they who are disunifying so many countries across the world. They have created this carnage and this drop in economic growth, and we're emerging from that, which is wonderful. But now we need to work together to supercharge the economy. This should be a bipartisan issue, and that's what the Endless Frontier Act is all about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously COVID and the pandemic had a big, you know, had a big role in the economy as well. But let me ask you this, because you are, for want of a better word, a Lugar Republican. He was your mentor, the late senator from Indiana, Richard Lugar. I had interviewed him in the past. You know, he really had bipartisan success on many issues, especially of foreign policy, and we're discussing that now. But also I want to ask you how to interpret that in domestic policy, because despite the intense polarization, what President Biden laid out last night and what he's been doing, certainly for his first 100 days, has significant support across the United States. Clearly, highest support amongst Democrats and independents, but also support amongst Republicans. And I just wonder whether that matters to, I mean, to you, of course, but, you know, you hear some, you know, slightly less bipartisan Republicans, you know, just sort of dumping all over that, right? But well, it's popular with the people. What the president is doing is popular with the people. And to be a viable party, you've got to make measures that they relate to.
Sure. Well, what the president is saying is popular with the people. Polling of some of his priorities that he announced last night, like family leave and housing affordability and pre-K and childcare and training and retraining all our workers so that they can meaningfully participate in this dynamic economy. All of these things are very important to Republicans and Democrats alike. Unfortunately, President Biden has talked about these categories, but he's not really consulted with Republicans. We saw this with a $1.9 trillion so-called COVID relief package that in the end had a whole lot more to do with provisions unrelated to COVID. We're seeing this again with the proposed $2.5 trillion infrastructure package, which they're now branding something else. It's not mostly infrastructure. And so the more the American people learn about this, the more they're going to want us to work together, as you say, in a bipartisan fashion to advance the advertised priorities, which indeed are popular among the American people.
So I wonder whether you think the White House has heard what you've been saying. You know, obviously, a lot of Republicans have said, you know, President Biden campaigned on talking about bipartisanship, but now he's not listening to us. Look at these things that are passed with entirely Democratic votes. So Anita Hill, who is his senior advisor, said today that there isn't, in fact, a specific timeline for congressional Democrats to, quote, go it alone on Biden's sweeping infrastructure proposals. So clearly indicating and saying, frankly, that they want to give a lot more time for negotiations with you, with the Republicans. That's good, right? I mean, that's a hand across the aisle.
That's really encouraging. I'm happy to hear that. I will note that the last time I went over to the White House was invited into the Oval Office and discussed the $1.9 trillion package. Myself and nine other Republicans brought a counterproposal. We thought that was going to be the beginning of a negotiation, and we're led to believe that. The following day, the so-called reconciliation process was initiated, allowing Democrats to push through the $1.9 trillion package. I only say that as a word of caution. I hope that doesn't happen again. The American people really do want us to work together and find common ground on some of the priorities I've identified before. By the way, all of which I have developed concrete solutions in each of those categories. So let's hope that the words are met with deeds, and that we can really work together and show unity, not just as it relates to confronting communist China and the threat they pose to us and the rest of the Western world, but also on these domestic issues, which are so important to the lives and livelihoods of all Americans.
Exactly. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us. It's really good to hear you on this issue. And of course, I meant Anita Dunn, not Anita Hill. Anita Dunn is the senior advisor for President Biden. Thank you very much indeed. Now, before President Biden spoke of the many challenges in front of him, he addressed the history being made on the podium behind him.
Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President. No president has ever said those words from this podium. No president has ever said those words. And it's about time.
Yes, Kamala Harris and Nancy Pelosi are first in the line of presidential succession. It is historic for women, but the fight to be heard and respected continues around the world. On a digital platform called Everyone's Invited, thousands of women have shared their stories of sexism, misogyny, and sexual violence. Soma Serra is the founder, and she's joining me from here in London. And with me from Los Angeles is Camila Willingham, an activist and writer. Welcome, both of you, to the program. And I just want to start by asking you, Soma, just to g- give your experience and what led you to create this platform, Everyone's Invited?
So I started this platform back in June after having many conversations with friends about our experiences through our teenage years and university. And it was sadly revealed that so many of us had had these experiences of sexual violence and rape culture growing up. And when I talk about rape culture, I'm talking about a culture where things that aren't normal are actually normalized. So this is a wider culture, which includes behaviors such as sexual harassment, misogyny, sexism, the derogatory sexist comments. And it's when things like the non-consensual sharing of intimate photos and sexual harassment is normalized, this can actually act as a gateway to more extreme acts of rape and sexual assault. So it was actually after I shared my own experiences of this culture on my Instagram, and I was immediately completely overwhelmed with stories from everyone I knew really reaching out to me saying how much they resonated with everything I was saying about rape culture, and also began sharing their testimonies of sexual violence and abuse and harassment. So in response to this viral moment of stories, which I shared on my Instagram, I decided to create a more permanent platform called Everyone's Invited for survivors to share their stories and to raise awareness.
So let me turn to you, Camila, because you shared your experiences as a, you know, Harvard Law School back in 2011 on a documentary that actually was aired by CNN called The Hunting Ground. Tell me about your experience, and are you surprised, heartened by the response to Everyone's Invited?
Well, I was a law student back in 2011. I had just turned 25, and I went out with friends and, like, you know, crashed at my place and woke up to being sexually assaulted by a classmate. And I did all the things that I thought were the right things to do. You know, I reported it to the police. I reported it to my school. I tried to hold out hope that at least one of those processes would deliver justice. And it failed. Both systems failed. My school actually, or at least professors at my school, were very retaliatory towards me, especially as I started speaking out. And the criminal justice process was a dead end that was mainly re-traumatizing. And seeing the response now to Everyone's Invited some 5 years after I spoke out is really heartening. I guess any platform that gives survivors an opportunity to speak out in a way that feels safe. I love that people can speak out anonymously and still have such an immense impact. I also love seeing that our society seems more open to hearing these stories. And whenever we get this flood of so many stories, it's really hard to deny that we have a problem and that there are people who we are failing to serve in our society.
I have to read the legal response from that person in your case. Harvard did suspend the accused, who denies any wrongdoing, and he was tried in 2015. He was convicted of non-sexual assault and battery against your friend. He was cleared of sexual assault, and following the trial, Harvard reinstated him. So rape culture and activism, it's obviously, I mean, you know, I want to hear from both of you what exactly it means, because it's a very, very strong term. So you started to talk about it. What exactly does it mean? And what does it look like? The culture.
So I'm talking about a wider culture where everything in this culture is actually interconnected. So all the experiences and all the behaviors, as well as the deeply entrenched sexist and misogynistic attitudes and beliefs that actually inform this culture. So it's really everything from the sexual harassment. You know, this could be groping at a Christmas party or at a club. It encompasses the image-based abuse, which is a consequence of the rise of social media and technology. So this includes things like upskirting, the non-consensual sharing of intimate photos, as well as also encompassing the serious criminal acts of rape and assault. It's really important to point out that it's an incremental culture and one thing leads to the next. And, you know, it's about dehumanizing behaviors. And when an individual is dehumanized, you just can't respect them. And that's when they become vulnerable to violation. So it's not just about the most extreme acts of rape and assault. It's really about everything else within the culture. It's about the victim blaming and the barriers to reporting, the failures of the wider system that allow the most extreme acts to exist and thrive without any repercussions.
I want to play this part of an interview that I conducted with Laura Bates, who, as you know, probably is the founder of the Everyday Sexism Project, and she's written, you know, books about this. Here's what she told me about this issue that you're talking about now.
It's very common in schools for me to hear young people say things like, rape is a compliment, really. It's not rape if she enjoys it. To have this idea that foreplay, that for girls, crying is part of foreplay. That's another comment, a direct quote from a young teenager. Many young people are accessing from a very young age really quite extreme and misogynistic online pornography. In the UK, for example, we know that 60% of young people have seen it by the age of 14 and that a quarter are 12 or younger when they first see it. I would imagine that those statistics are similar in the United States.
So I want to ask you both, what kind of steps you think can be taken to basically avoid this kind of teaching of certain members of society, certain boys who basically get, apparently, according to the research, a lot of their sex ed from pornography. And we've just seen that in the UK, there's been a survey by the think tank Higher Education Policy Institute that 58% question said students should have to pass a test to show they fully understand sexual consent before starting university. Camila, can I ask you about that? How does that strike you? Because often, obviously, university is the first time people go away from home and they get lessons, obviously, certainly now in freshman week. But this is about being taught before and actually passing a test so that you actually recognize what consent means.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting idea. And if the first time we're having real conversations about consent is in the context of university admissions, when we're, you know, concerned that somebody's going to rape someone, we failed and we're doing it way too late. I think these conversations have to start much earlier. With comprehensive sex education and a broader cultural destigmatizing of talking about sex in general. I also think when we talk about rape culture, it's really important to acknowledge that its foundations, it's rooted in patriarchy and systems and beliefs in male dominance and what that means about the roles of the genders. And so, if we're brought up in a society where sex is thought of as something that women are supposed to guard and give up and men are supposed to take it and it's their job to dominate, already our conversations about consent are going to be skewed because we also have to recognize the role of coercion. So I think the idea of a test is interesting, but it makes me uncomfortable because it does set people up to fail if we're not also making a real effort to talk about these things as early as elementary school.
So let me ask you, Soma, because you've actually taken your platform and your concerns and the fact that, you know, so many thousands of people have come onto the platform. You've taken it to schools. You talked to the headmaster of Eton, which is a very prominent private school, boys' school here in the UK. And I just want to play this soundbite, and then I want to ask you your experiences from what you've tried to tell, you know, those in charge.
Schools are actively and aggressively not wanting to tell the truth about what's going on their campuses because the first campuses to do so will be, you know, the kind of known as the rape campuses where they actually have a rape problem. But, you know, rape is happening at all college campuses and there are perverse economic and reputational incentives to hide those numbers.
So that, again, is from the Hunting Ground, which Camila was part of. But when you took it to Eton or wherever else you might have done, what did they say?
You know, I think you know, it was really important for us to try and emphasize that this is a culture that exists across the board. It exists in all schools and all universities and all of societies. So far, we've had a really encouraging response from schools and universities across the UK who have been having a very lively dialogue with their students. And we're very pleased to see it going on so far, but there is a lot more work to be done. But again, I'd really like to emphasize that this is a universal culture. It's everywhere.
I just want to read from your platform. Basically, you know, the instruction you're urging, don't be a bystander, call it out, take action to stop it from happening. If you witness misogyny and sexism, challenge it through conversation and do this with empathy and understanding, not anger and rejection. That is really interesting, Soma, because you obviously hear from a lot of boys who are also trying to figure out, you know, how to deal in this situation. And instead of being, you know, cancelled for a mistake, and I'm talking about a mistake, not a violent act, not a criminal act. You know, how do you think boys and girls, men and women, need to discuss this maybe between themselves or make them understand that this is not the way forward anymore?
Yes, everyone's invited. We are really keen on emphasizing the importance of empathy and understanding and reconciliation. It's so important that we're trying our best to listen to each other, listen to our survivors, and listen to all sides of the story. We don't believe in criminalizing young people and ostracizing or canceling people, because I don't think that really moves us forward as a society. And, you know, when you point the finger and you play the blame game and you narrow it down to an institution or a demographic or an individual, you're actually really limiting the problem and making it seem like it only exists there. Mm-hmm. When actually it's so much deeper than that. It's in the foundations, it's in the structures, it's everywhere.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much, both of you, for sharing your experiences and making awareness so much greater. Soma Sarah, Camila Willingham, thanks for joining us. And of course, if you've been affected by this issue or know someone who needs help, do contact your National Domestic and Sexual Abuse Helpline. And we continue now with the importance of education. Cornel West is a philosopher, scholar, and civil rights activist whose searing speeches have educated and inspired many. And here he is speaking to Walter Isaacson about why classics must remain in the curriculum, as well as Biden's first 100 days.
Thank you, Christian, and Dr. Cornel West. Welcome to the show.
It's a blessing to be here, and I salute you for your illustrious career, my brother. 50 years ago, we arrived at Harvard at the same time, and we're still going. We are two blessed brothers, I tell you.
Well, that's one of the things you've always taught in your lessons, is to remember each morning how blessed you can be. You've just written an op-ed piece with a partner decrying Howard University and other places that are minimizing or getting rid of the classics department. Why is teaching the classics so important?
You know, my brother, I'm thoroughly convinced that we're living in a moment of spiritual decay and moral decrepitude in the American empire. We've got to come up with countervailing forces and countervailing weights against rule of money, rule of mediocrity, rule of military might, rule of narrow conformity, and rule of indifference and callousness. And the best of the classics of any civilization, any empire, any culture has to do with trying to convince us to involve ourselves in a quest for truth and beauty and goodness. And then for some of us, like myself as a Christian, the holy.
You talk about spiritual decay, and you say it's a moral decline, and it's a deep intellectual narrowness that's crept in. How did the classics help us push back against that?
The classics force us to come to terms with the most terrifying question we could ever raise, which is, what does it mean to be human? The unexamined life is not a life of the human, in Plato's Apology, line 38a. And what does that human mean? Well, it comes from the Latin humanda, which means burial. We are disappearing creatures. We're vanishing organisms on the way to bodily extinction. And therefore, the question becomes, who will we be in the meantime? What kind of virtues will we enact? What kind of visions will we pursue? What kinds of values will we try to embody? And once you raise that question, what it means to be human, then you begin to see, on the one hand, like Shakespeare and Dante have taught us, like Toni Morrison and John Coltrane have taught us, it's dark in our history. Most of our history is a history of domination and oppression. It's a history of hatred. It's a history of contempt. It's a history of fear-driven cruelty. But what is the best of our history? Counterweights against that. And that's everywhere you look. Every civilization, every continent, every race, every gender, every sexual orientation. And once you come to terms with that, then the question becomes, how do you become equipped? Mm-hmm. What kind of spiritual and moral armor do you have that allows you to think critically, that allows you to open yourself to others, that allows you to act courageously?
What did Frederick Douglass learn from both reading the classics and engaging in a conversation with the great Western canon of thinkers?
Well, I think he was already a freedom fighter because he did not want to be a slave, but he was able to come to terms with languages because he had foreign languages. His languages had an African backdrop. When he in the United States, he had learned these European languages, English language, and the French and the German. And in those languages, he was able to tease out, as can anybody, even though he's very distinctive in many ways, and eloquence. And what is eloquence? Cicero and Quintilian say eloquence is wisdom speaking. What is wisdom speaking? Having the courage to learn how to die. And you learn how to die by questioning your assumptions and presuppositions. Anytime you let certain assumptions and presuppositions go, that's a form of death to allow you to be reborn, to allow you to grow, allow you to develop, allow you to mature. And we live in an empire, my brother, in many ways it's grown powerful, grown rich, but it hasn't grown up. F.O. Matheson used to say that America in some ways would be distinctive because it would move from perceived innocence to corruption without a mediating stage of maturity. And so we begin with this notion of we're innocent. No other nation believes that they're innocent. How can you be authorizers of devastation of indigenous peoples and African slavery and then view yourself as innocent? James Baldwin said that innocence itself is the crime before you even commit the crime. You need to grow up. This is not Peter Pan. This is not Disneyland. You got to be mature. And it's possible for any human being to be innocent and naive, to be mature and separate childishness from childlikeness. Childlikeness is the sign of maturity. Childishness, you need to grow up.
To what extent did Martin Luther King gain that maturity by being part of this conversation with the ancients, with the classics, with the Western heritage that you now say is under assault at some universities?
Well, Martin Luther King Jr., of course, learned it from coming from a people who had been hated for 400 years and still tried to teach the world so much about love. And it goes from Martin King to John Coltrane's Love Supreme to James Baldwin's love-soaked essays to Toni Morrison's Beloved. He comes from a people who had been traumatized for 400 years, but still, at our best, decided to be wounded healers rather than wounded hurters. It came from a people who had been terrorized for 400 years, all the way up to Brother Floyd himself, all the way up to Brother Andrew Brown, all the way up to Breonna Taylor. But the best of our response has been what? To call for freedom for everybody, not terrorize others, not create a Black version of the Ku Klux Klan. The Black people had opted for creating a Black version of the Ku Klux Klan. There'd been a civil war every generation. There have been terrorist cells in every chocolate section of the city. No, it was the tradition of the virtues of a vision that embraces all, that is predicated on the humanity of each and every one of us, each human being made in the image and likeness of a God that gives us a value, a worth, a sanctity, a dignity. That's been the best of Black leadership. And once that Black leadership is reduced to just a quest for dollars and smartness rather than justice and deep commitment to love and compassion, then you lose the best of the Black tradition. See, I argue, Brother Walter, that the Black freedom tradition has been the leaven in the American Democratic loaf. We've seen that in the last election. You got 58% of our white brothers voted for Trump, 53% of our white sisters voted for Trump. It wasn't for the Black vote, for the most part, especially the Black sisters' vote, that we'd have Trump again. we could have a neo-fascist America. So that the best of black folk has always been one of broadening the expansion of not just rights and liberties, but of the quality of our relations to one another. So it's also about the hesed, that great concept that comes from the genius of Hebrew scripture, that loving kindness to be spread to orphan and widow and fatherless and motherless, to be spread to the weak and the vulnerable. And if you give up on that and it becomes simply Thrasymachus, might makes right. If you give up on that, it just becomes a matter of survival of the slickest. If you give up on that and push the 10 commandments away, you only end up with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught, thou shalt get over by any means and make as much money and status and spectacle as you can. You lose your democracy, you lose your soul. And my dear brother, the greatest play ever written about the American empire, which is Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh. What does it profit to the nation to gain the whole world and lose its soul?
How do people who are not part of the Western tradition take back being, having their voice be part of that Western tradition and the classics?
Oh, you challenge it. Because keep in mind, this wonderful, wonderful formulation by the great Henry James. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote a letter January 12th, 1901 to Robert Louis Stevenson. He said, no theory that, no theory is kind to us that cheats us of seeing. No theory is kind to us that cheats us of seeing. And what did he mean by that? What he meant by that was that, in fact, every theory has a certain limitedness and narrowness. And the aim is to broaden what we see so that we're not short-sighted, we're not myopic. And I would add to feel more deeply so that we're not caught in forms of indifference. You know, the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, indifference to evil is more evil than evil itself. He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. So when you see more broadly and feel more deeply and then act more courageously, lo and behold, you accent the best of who we are. And even when we have the best of who we are, we still have our limitations. We have our faults. We have our foibles. That's why democracy itself is a proximate solution to insoluble problems. You're never going to get away with the hatred, the insecurity, and the anxieties that go hand in hand with who we are as human beings. But we can have mechanisms of accountability vis-a-vis the most vulnerable. That's democracy. That's why voices from below can merge to try to shape the destiny of a nation.
In the January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill, some of the people wore Greek helmets and they carried flag that said, you know, Malon Labe, meaning come get our weapons. It was almost like they were at the Battle of Thermopylae. They were channeling the classics for white supremacy. What did you think when you saw that?
Well, I mean, one, my brother, as a black man in America, as a revolutionary Christian, I'm never surprised by evil and never paralyzed by despair. So any tradition can be used in a vicious manner. Any religion can be used in a vicious manner. Any institution can. And there's no accident that there's a whole host of resources in the classical tradition of the West or any other civilization that lends itself to interpretations grounded in a hatred and a greed and attempt to dominate others. Yet those same traditions also are open to being used and deployed to bring in, call into question, to critique, to undermine hatred and greed and domination. And so it's like the Ku Klux Klan. And here they got my Jesus and my cross, and they think that they're Christians. Well, there's a long history of Christians who have been involved in form of hatred and greed and promote structures of domination. I shouldn't be surprised, but that doesn't mean that those ugly versions of Christianity somehow exhaust the best of prophetic Christianity, what Dorothy Day was about, you see, what Martin King was about, what Fannie Lou Hamer was about, what Philip Berrigan was about. Say it would be true with Judaism, what Rabbi Heschel was about. Say it would be true with secular traditions as well. You see, what Muriel Rukeyser was about. What Malcolm X, the prophetic Muslim, was about. Those are forces for good at their best.
You were not a supporter of Joe Biden when he ran for the president. You supported Bernie Sanders. Now that we're 100 days into the Biden administration, have you revised your assessment of him and maybe think that he could be a little bit like Lyndon Baines Johnson and surprise us, especially on the issue of race?
I think that Biden is going to surprise us. He surprised me. When he went in, my view was that he was tied to four crimes against humanity. Mass incarceration, unleashing Wall Street greed with the Glass-Steagall Act repealed, with the invasion and occupation of Iraq and Israeli occupation. All of those, he would not say a critical word about in any substantive way. And in many ways, he was the architect and supporter of them. In coming into office, he hits the issue of Yemen and Afghanistan head on. Relief bill, infrastructure bill. Deeply concerned about police brutality, talks about white supremacy, talks about Jim Crow. He reminds me very much of LBJ, who started as a white supremacist from Jim Crow, Texas, and ended up one of the major forces for good against white supremacy. That's why you never give up on people. You never know which way they're headed. You never know what kind of change they can put forward. And if Biden continues in this way, he's going to be very much like LBJ and will be a much stronger force for good against white supremacy on the ground than Barack Obama was. Now, Barack Obama had the symbol because he's brilliant, he's black, he's poised and so forth. Didn't have the courage, didn't have the willingness to fight that Biden does when it comes to this issue, when it comes to a variety of issues. So who would know, who would think that Joseph Biden from Scranton, Pennsylvania could become such a force for good for progressives? Now, I still have criticisms until he hasn't moved on the Middle Eastern issue the way I would like. And in relation to what's going on in Haiti right now, I'm very critical in terms of the dictatorial rule and his unwillingness to call it into question. So there's a number of things I continue to put pressure on, and I will continue to put pressure on any elected official, no matter what color. But it's always in the name of moral and spiritual issues linked to spreading Hesed to the most vulnerable in any society.
What was your reaction to the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd? And might it help us get further along on police reform and even race issues?
I was just glad to see that they had a fair trial and a policeman went to jail. Just so rare, as you know, my brother, that a policeman actually goes to jail when they shoot down so many of our fellow citizens. And as you know, over 1,000 fellow citizens are shot down every year, disproportionately black and brown, but not exclusively. You got a lot of white brothers and sisters who are shot down as well. This is arbitrary power deployed. That's what democracies are about. How do you curtail and attenuate the use of arbitrary power, especially when it's tied to the state? If you can't do that, you don't have a serious democracy, you see. That's why black folk, for most of the time we're here, We've been victims of American democracy, as Malcolm X said, because the arbitrary power of white supremacy has been so vicious against us. So I was glad to see it. I just hope it's not an isolated incident. And I hope that it can become much more institutionalized in terms of fair trials and ensuring that people are not able to use arbitrary power, especially violent power, against fellow citizens, especially those who historically have been so hated and terrorized and traumatized like we black folk.
You talk about the importance of education and that education can help us emote, help us cry. Let me express my condolences. You just lost your mother, who was a great educator. Tell me about her.
Yeah, well, Mom, you know, she was the kind of walking truth, beauty, goodness, and grounded in the holy, because she believed fundamentally, as a Christian woman, as a black woman coming out of Jim Crow, Louisiana, born in Crawley, Louisiana, that's my roots, just like New Orleans for you, my brother, that she wanted to open herself, to empty herself, to donate herself, to give herself, to make the world a better place. She understood if the kingdom of God is within you, then everywhere you go, you ought to leave a little heaven behind. And anytime somebody sees me, they see her, because her afterlife's at work in part in my life, trying to leave a little heaven behind. It could be Socratic heaven. It could be prophetic heaven. It could be a little Richard Pryor comic heaven. but it's some kind of helping to empower somebody to make the world better. It's tikkun olam to amend the world, to make sure you leave it just a little more sweet and joyful than when you found it. And that's mom, that's Irene B. West. Nobody like her. One of a kind.
Dr. Cornell West, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, my dear brother. Salute you, man. God bless you and your family too, man.
Same to you.
And finally, we've heard a lot about the abuse suffered by domestic workers in Persian Gulf states. Now, some of them are using TikTok to bring that to light, like Brenda Dama from Kenya, whose video about her struggles as a house cleaner in Saudi Arabia has gained nearly a million views.
It's all by your side.
Don't got it. Don't got it. Don't got it. Don't got it. I actually have that one. And that one. Not that one.
Now, most foreign domestic workers in that region are employed through a sponsorship system that gives their employers almost total control over them. Through TikTok, they can share their frustrations and maybe start trying to help change this system. That's it for now. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.